Talofalava. This is the summer edition of Pacific Beat here on ABC Radio Australia. Coming up, you'll hear how two all-Indigenous crews have been established in Australia by the Rural Fire Service to protect sacred sites and communities living on reserves.
All of Aboriginal people at Alice Edmund Village, it's always been that way.
Also, you'll hear how one resident on the Cocos Islands, which are a tiny circle of islands northeast of Perth in the middle of the Indian Ocean, has a plan that could create a new coconut industry for the islands, provided he can keep the ducks away.
Can't be too many ducks that eat coconut around the world, so but these ones do, as you can see.
But next, you're going to hear about the second most expensive spice in the world after saffron. I'm talking about vanilla and why Fiji is trying to get into the vanilla trade market. Hello, I'm Talia Olatia. Now, it's a common ingredient in ice cream and food flavouring and can also be found in items as diverse as candles. Despite this, though, there's a worldwide shortage in natural vanilla. However, one Australian investor is backing a project to make Fiji a world supplier in vanilla and cash in on the growing demand and rising prices. And as Evan Wasuka reports, there's already some success in the Pacific, from small growers in Papua New Guinea to the iconic Lala Vanilla in Tonga.
Peaking at US$600 per kilo, the price of vanilla beans has rivaled that of silver this year. The world centre for vanilla is Madagascar, but production has been reduced as a result of cyclones and supply problems. Australian businessman Frederick Gulson is working on a project to fill the gap in the market. He intends to turn Fiji into a major vanilla producer. Mr. Gulson is using his experience with large-scale grape production and cattle in Australia on a new venture, Fiji Vanilla Plantations.
We've got substantially larger blocks of land to deal with, which will be, 20 acres, 30 acres, with up to 100,000 plants.
Fiji Vanilla Plantations is looking to have its first harvest in about 2 years' time. Mr. Gulson says the nature of the crop means only a long-term approach can be profitable.
It's a once-a-year crop. Secondly, a lot of the farmers we've spoken to aren't aware of the prices. And it takes 3 years. So you're saying, a farmer would be saying, I need to wait 3 years before I get a return.
In Papua New Guinea, vanilla is a favoured cash crop for smallholders because of its high international price. Small growers sell to larger companies for export overseas. Monica Otto is with the Foundation for Women in Agriculture and Development in East Sepik.
It's a real money earner for a small person at the grassroots level because at 1 kilo, they can score up to 500.
Miss Otto works with growers to improve the quality of their vanilla beans by sharing essential information.
It's the brown, black color, and it has to be sticky. You hold it, and then when you roll it between your finger, it has to spring back. And so that's the quality we train our farmers to look at.
In Tonga, Heilala Vanilla has set the gold standard for vanilla production. Jennifer Bogus is Heilala's CEO.
In New Zealand is where we do all our extraction. We produce vanilla extract, vanilla paste, vanilla syrup, vanilla sugar, vanilla powder.
Its vanilla is most in demand in the US, where it's used in high-end restaurants in New York. Heilala Vanilla's products have also been the subject of positive reviews in the New York Times and Forbes magazine. The company was set up in Tonga in 2002 as a cyclone recovery project and has flourished ever since. Ms. Bogus says 2 50-acre lots of vanilla were planted last year and will be ready in 2024.
So we're really excited about that because that will mean employment for over 200 women and also obviously, a huge step change in our supply chain.
While world prices for vanilla are at a high, Ms. Bogus expects prices to dip next year.
The prices will soften. They really have to because what's happened with, really high prices is that the demand has dropped off. So customers, chefs, food manufacturers in particular might still be using real vanilla, but they're probably just using less of it or dosing it lower.
Frederick Gulson of Fiji Vanilla Plantations say they would operate profitably even if the price drops to around US$576 per kilo.
All our financial figures are based on $576 per kilo. And why do we do that? Because
We're prudent and cautious agricultural people. We never go for market. We hope to get to market, but we always allow.
While there's plenty of promise for vanilla in the Pacific, it also faces a threat from changing climate. Dr. Bruce Smallfield is a scientist with New Zealand's Plant and Food Research. He's been researching vanilla production in Tonga.
For the last 3 years, there have been very poor vanilla yields in Davao, the northern island, and the main vanilla-producing island in Tonga. For some reason, the plants haven't really flowered properly.
Dr. Smallfield will be part of a five-year project funded by the New Zealand government to research the impact of climate on vanilla.
Trying to unravel just what is causing these problems with flowering and how we might improve production and make the production more sustainable.
The outcome of the research can mean a sweeter return for Pacific countries.
Reporter Evan Wasuka with that story there. The Cocos Islands are a tiny circle of islands northeast of Perth in the middle of the Indian Ocean. Only about 600 people live there, and 500 of them are Cocos Malays Australian. They were brought there 150 years ago to work on the coconut plantations on the islands, and in 1984 they voted to formally become part of Australia. Now, the coconut industry is no longer viable, but one resident has a plan that could create a new coconut industry for the islands. Despite having no soil, no capital, a brace of ducks he doesn't know what to do with, and extremely high freight costs, micro-farmer Tony Lacey is determined to build a viable agricultural business on the Cocos Islands. Emma Wynn visited his farm to see it for herself.
I'm in a pretty extraordinary farm. We're surrounded by coconut palms. There are about 30 ducks wandering around. There's a lime tree, a shade house, and some sea salt evaporation beds. Tony Lacey is the unlikely farmer here. His wife's job brought the couple and their four kids to the Cocos Islands 10 years ago. Tony has a background as a winemaker, which there's not a lot of call for on a tropical island. So he started looking around for other things to do with food, and that's when he discovered the abandoned farm. Tony started off by telling me how a tiny coral atoll in the middle of the Indian Ocean that only has 14 square kilometres of land in total came to have a farm at all.
So when the Cocos Malays voted to become part of Australia, Australian government obviously upgraded infrastructure on the island. So two schools, two clinics on both sides. And also they thought they'd engage a horticulturalist for 2 years and also invest in infrastructure to create a farm. Makes sense. They had 2,000 people back then. Having said that, there was no work for them, so it ended up dropping down to about 500, where it is today. So the horticulture was here for 1 or 2 years. Underground irrigation, big shed, cool room, hydroponics. There were bananas, pawpaws, limes, sapote, guavas, pineapples as well. But when he left, like everything, when the driver leaves, it just goes pear-shaped. So it just fell into disrepair. No one took it on. No one crazy enough took it on. So having a food science background, I looked at it and thought, wow, this is a bit of a jungle. The kids were hanging around my ankles, but I couldn't spend all day watching the waves come in. So with the kids, so I thought, wow, why don't we take on this project? So we took on the farm back about 5 years ago and slowly started developing a lot of different things such as sea salt. I was inspired by a gentleman over at Home Island, one of the elders. He was evaporating sea salt by cooking the seawater in a 44-gallon drum. I said to him, mate, there's another way you can do it. Just use the sun, make a solar evaporation pan. So we got some seed funding and we developed a trial sea salt evaporation system using the sun and glass panels. And that worked really well. So well that we thought, well, we really need the farm now because we can grow herbs, tropical herbs, to blend with the sea salt. So that morphed into a little micro business, Cocos Island sea salt and herbs. So that was the first little project.
Things haven't always gone to plan. The farm has initiated a few experiments in agriculture that haven't exactly paid off, including the ducks, which now exist on a diet that includes fresh coconut.
I'll just see if I can move these ducks because they're a bit annoying for me, they are. Maybe they're cute for you, but
he's just gone to get an axe to deal with those annoying ducks, but luckily it's just to split open a coconut for them to eat.
Anyway, so the ducks, there can't be too many ducks that eat coconut around the world, so but these ones do, as you can see. Duck, duck, duck. Yeah, the ducks were a trial. We do a lot of different trials. They were like, okay, how can we We'll do 100 duck campaigns. So we sold some of the bread and a percentage went to buy in produce for the ducks. Because the thing is, the key is about feeding them. And so we thought, well, why should we ship in frozen chickens from a farm out of Perth when we should have a source of meat here apart from fish? Oh, they're getting out, are they? No. But then we reached about 20 or 30 ducks, and then we realised we haven't got enough food for them. We'd have to buy in like $60 a bag feed from Perth. So it wasn't viable. So we're trying to keep the numbers around about 30, 40. And now I've got 30 or 40, I can't really kill any because I'm a bit of a soft.
Another experiment that didn't quite take off involved planting lemongrass at the farm.
So then we planted 10,000 lemongrass to make lemongrass tea. After I came back on a sailing trip to Africa from here, came back with all these ideas, went to Mauritius, thought, wow, herbal tea, great. Over there, they blend some coconut essence with lemongrass. So I came back and said, well, we'll do a whole herbal range. So we made lemongrass and lime tea, 100% lemongrass tea, lemongrass and coconut. I thought, great. So after 6 months, we released that, and then I realised, oh, hang on, people still love coffee. So we realised that wasn't going to be the export success that cocos needed.
The copra and coconut oil industry ended in the 1980s, but the islands are chock full of the coconut palms, and the coconuts are free for anyone who wants to pick them up. They are essentially the island's only natural resource, but it took a while for Tony to come round to the idea of using the coconuts in the farm. While the coconuts might be free, getting anything off the islands is very expensive. It's said to be the most expensive shipping route in the world. And if you want to export anything, you have to either send it by shipping container, which takes about 6 weeks to get to Perth, or you can air freight something which costs about $10 a kilo.
Then we had an inquiry from a Japanese company that wanted only Australian coconut oil. So I've gone, right, Japan. And being the only commercial coconut ex-industry, there's the potential. So we inquired how many litres per year. That was exciting, but as we suspected, it was the cost of freight getting it off the island. Therefore, not viable for them. Therefore, we had to create a whole new range of products. So we created the body moisturising products, a range of lip balms, a lot of body butters, and also a range of body scrubs. We were just about to move into a range of coconut oil-based soap, but we still had an issue in the back of my mind with weight getting it off the island.
At this point, you might be wondering why the farm continues at all. Well, it all comes down to creating jobs for locals. Unemployment among the local Cocos Malay community runs at about 20 to 30%. Tony currently employs 2 part-time staff, but if the farm business takes off, that could create many more jobs. And now he thinks he's found the product that could do just that.
And then someone said, well, hang on, Tony, there's a little family business north of Port Douglas and they're picking up coconuts with a wheelbarrow. And I thought, what are they doing? So I freeze-framed the video and I thought, of course, it's coconut chips. It's lightweight, vegan, organic. It's a health food snack for kids, adults. And I thought, right, girls, let's stop everything. Don't worry about the soap. Let's just focus on chips. So the girls focused on the production techniques. I then focused on the new label and a new branding for our coconut chips. So 6 months down the track, we've released them.
We realised that, yeah, we should be able to utilise all these coconuts that are falling to waste. So what we do, we harvest twice a week. We've got the young fellas that come out, take the trippy, and they head out and they collect coconuts on the side of the road.
Tony's hoping that if the chips take off and can be exported to the mainland, he will eventually be able to create 10 jobs and a viable business that his young staff members can eventually take over themselves.
So it's all about the coconut chips now, and hopefully that'll rejuvenate the whole Cocos Islands coconut industry and create a whole new industry for Australia. We're hoping. We live in hope. That's all we do, actually. We live in hope.
Sneaky sound of ducks there. That was the wild coconut farmer Tony Lacey speaking to ABC Radio Perth's Emma Wynn about his plans to create coconut chips.
Radio Australia now has a WhatsApp. Just add +614 375 19 385 to your phone. It means you can message Radio Australia from anywhere in the Pacific. So add +614 375 19 385 and send us a message. Tell us what you want to hear and join the conversations on Radio Australia.
Coming up on Pacific Beat with me, Talia Olatea, you'll hear how two all-Indigenous crews have been established in Australia by the Rural Fire Service to protect sacred sites and communities living on reserves. But first, how about a little bit of music? The 10 finalists for the Pacific Break competition were announced on the weekend, and Piran Latan is an all-female lineup from West Tanna in Vanuatu who are in the running to be on the stage at WOM Adelaide in 2020. Now, Piran Latan sing in their native language from West Tanna, and here's their entry to the Pacific Break competition, which really caught the judges' attention and made them one of our finalists.
You're my demon.
Piran Latan there from West Tanna in Vanuatu, one of the 10 finalists of the Pacific Break competition.
Island Music brings you the finest reggae from Jamaica and around the world with a spotlight on the freshest Pacifica talent.
Join me, Rick Howe, for Island Music, a two-hour journey from the foundation of Jamaican popular music from ska, rocksteady, roots, dub and dancehall, plus the freshest new releases and a spotlight on emerging talent from around the Pacific.
Every Saturday with Rick Howe from 12 till 2 p.m. PNG time on Radio Australia across the Pacific.
Now, you would have heard how fires are ravaging the east coast of Australia in recent months, but in the far west of the state, a different kind of firefighting has been taking place. For the first time, two all-Indigenous crews have been established by the Rural Fire Service. These crews are trained to protect sacred sites and communities living on reserves using their traditional knowledge. Jesse Davies reports from Bourke.
Wait for this fire to come out a little bit closer and then we're going to go out through a bit of water and hopefully slow it down a bit.
In a remote part of western New South Wales, Dale Barker fights a bushfire on a land that is sacred to the Budgety people.
Three on fire here. Roger.
He's one of eight new Indigenous firefighters hired by the New South Wales Rural Fire Service. Their knowledge makes them an invaluable asset in fighting bushfires on Indigenous lands.
All of Aboriginal people at Alice Edward Village. It's always been that way.
The next day, he's on Nyambar country on the fringe of Bourke in far western New South Wales.
The majority of these houses are prone to fire, and if they do get a fire, they're going to catch on pretty quickly.
About 100 people live on this old mission. Many residents here don't have smoke alarms, and rubbish has been left to build up, creating a major fire hazard.
It means a lot to me to help the community, but just helping the community out and seeing some of the younger Aboriginal kids watching us work and then maybe thinking, oh yeah, I want to do that one day.
The recruits, like Barker, were hand-selected by their elders and completed months of training.
You've got to carry about 20 kilos, I think it was, and you had to do about 15 laps of a football oval, and you had to do it under 45 minutes.
In time, the crews will use cultural burning techniques to better manage fuel loads. Right now, they're busy building trust with their communities. For Chris McHughes from Brewarrina, that comes easily.
For a First Nation people to another First Nation people, it's really easy. We call each other brother, sister, cars or uncle, aunt. We've got something to connect easy with.
Talking to kids in schools about the dangers of arson is a key part of their brief.
The kids, all they want to see is a red fire truck, so they light a fire and not knowing that, you know, it's the wrong thing. So why don't we, you know, chuck them on the truck, show them around. That's all they want to do is look at a fire truck.
In far western New South Wales, Indigenous people make up to two-thirds of the population. But Elder Grace Gordon says government schemes aimed at stemming unemployment don't always work.
Well, you know, most of the jobs that come to us, they're pilot projects that just happen for maybe a 6 or 12 month period. It doesn't allow for our people to future plan around their finances and around their career paths.
She says this program is already closing the gap.
They have an income, you know, where they can plan around future aspirations for themselves, like, you know, buying a house or buying a car, things that would probably a few years ago been just a dream.
That was Jessica Davies there with that story.
All in the Mind on Radio Australia. It's about the brain and behaviour.
I'm very interested in the impact things like health have on the mind and the brain.
And the fascinating connection between them.
If you have something like obesity, then the fat basically produces the inflammatory signals, which in turn affect the brain. And this is a whole kind of new area of science, which is what makes it unbelievably exciting.
All in the Mind, 3:30 p.m. Tuesday on Radio Australia.
You're listening to the summer edition of Pacific Beat. My name is Talia Olatia. How about a little bit more music for your Thursday? This is Common Kings with Wade in Your Water.
Thank you. type of girl I like to fill up on in the water. Really wanna rock a boat like a hurricane in a perfect storm, Lord. Ask her where she on her way to. Said a holla Eva. Say she love the North Shore. Bikini top, black Scots, and then board shorts. Paddle out, paddle out. Can I wait in your water? Can I wait in your water? Can I wait in your water? Till I catch a wave, Lord. Can I wait in your water? Can I wait in your water? Can I wait in your water? Sunlight can feel a warmth, yeah. Heat waves through the winter months, oh. Type of love never expire. Burn slow like a bonfire. Ask her where she on her way to. She said, like, yeah. Say she love the North Shore. Bikini top, black Scots, and then board shorts. Paddle out. Can I wait in your water? Can I wait in your water? Can I wait in your water? Cascade like my mail falls, oh. Pipeline through her open sea. I'm in love with her currently, yeah. Ask her where she on her way to. She said, well, Mayor. Say she love the North Shore. Bikini top, black Scots, and then board shorts. Paddle out, paddle out.
What a tune that was. Common Kings there with Wade in Your Water.
Australia Calling is a new documentary that explores the history of the ABC's international broadcasting. Covering wars, earthquakes, and regime changes across the Asia Pacific, Australia Calling explores the forces that shape Australia's international broadcasting services. To catch Australia Calling, tune in on ABC Australia TV on Friday, December 20, or watch it on ABC Australia iView.
Now, the UN committee that registers intangible cultural heritage held its annual meeting recently. And as you heard on Pacific Mornings, the ESR Moor was one of the items added to the register. The ESR Moor is a finely hand-woven mat fastened at the hem with two rows of green and red feathers. Now, traditionally woven with strippings of the pandanus plant, the final product is silk-like and coppery in colour. The production process is highly intricate and can take years, and its true value lies in its exchange during traditional ceremonies and rituals. Now, you can tell how the ESR Moor is obviously Samoan, but food can be recognised on UNESCO's list, which asks the question, what is a national dish? Because one nomination up for consideration by UNESCO is Singapore's bid to list its famous hawker culture, the tradition of eating street foods from a diverse range of backgrounds. But is it uniquely Singaporean? Southeast Asia correspondent Anne Barker has the story.
I'm sitting in a cafe in Jakarta and I've just ordered a Milo dinosaur. It's a drink that's ubiquitous in Southeast Asia, not so much in Indonesia, in fact. I haven't seen it on so many menus here, but it's huge in Singapore and Malaysia. And here it comes. It looks good. although it doesn't exactly look like a dinosaur. It's really just a normal drink of Milo with a mound of the chocolatey powder on top. If you add a scoop of ice cream, it becomes a Milo Godzilla. Two scoops and it's a Milo King Kong.
The name Milo Dinosaur itself seems to have come about in coffee shops in Singapore sometime during the 1990s.
Jeffrey Pakiam, a Singapore historian, knows virtually everything there is to know about the Milo dinosaur.
Part of the reason why those drinks were named Dinosaurs and Godzillas, it was partly because in the 90s, we had a lot of movies that were being shown in Singapore and Malaysia that were big blockbusters, including Jurassic Park, the remake of King Kong in 2005, there was Godzilla, I think, that came out in 1998 as well. So these sorts of monsters were very much, I think, part of popular culture at the time.
It's so ubiquitous, in fact, the chocolate drink has become more than a food. It's infused Singaporean culture itself. Where Aussie pubs might serve a beer tower or yard glass after a sporting match, Singaporeans are more likely to order a Milo tower, a giant glass of the sugary drink that comes with its own tap and can sell for 20 or more Singapore dollars. There's even a local pop group in Singapore that takes its name from the drink. Of course, Milo itself was invented in Australia in the 1930s by a chemical engineer, Thomas Main, on the northern New South Wales coast. But it's become a cultural institution in Singapore, so much so that Jeffrey Pakiam recently wrote an 11-page research paper on the Milo dinosaur as part of an ongoing national history of Singapore's culinary heritage.
I gave a talk recently at the National Museum on this, and I think in an audience of about 40, about a third of them put their hands up at the beginning of the talk when I asked them whether they felt that Milo dinosaur should be, did they consider it a part of our heritage already? I think there is a significant section of the population in Singapore that does.
Jeffrey Pakiam says some Singaporeans would support the Milo dinosaur's inclusion on UNESCO's Register of Intangible Cultural Heritage, which aims to protect the world's living traditions that contribute to social cohesion and encourage a sense of identity. The register already includes Indonesian batik and wayang puppet culture and Malaysia's Dondang Siang musical tradition, but nothing from Singapore. Earlier this year, Singapore nominated its famous hawker culture for inclusion to recognise the significance of its street food tradition to the national identity, though Jeffrey Pakiam acknowledges it's not unique to Singapore.
Most of our most famous dishes in the region, such as laksa, for instance, they are not the preserve of any one country or society. One can say that laksa has many different roots that come from outside the region as well, in that sense.
Not surprisingly, Singapore's nomination has upset many Malaysians who see their own hawker culture as far superior. In the same way, too, many Malaysians see the Milo dinosaur as their culinary creation, not Singapore's, on the grounds it was popular in Malaysia long before Singaporeans discovered it, and that Malaysians consume the drink in far bigger volumes than Singapore.
I think in the ideal situation, there should be joint nominations of food items if national governments or communities within these governments actually want to promote food items. Because at the end of the day, historically, most of our cuisines and food items in them, some of the things that we hold most dear to our hearts today, are all products of globalization to a large extent.
The food tensions don't stop there. Jeffrey Pakiam points to the competing claims in Singapore and Malaysia for ownership, or mastery at least, of dishes like chili crab, chendol, rendang, even Hainanese chicken, which appear in national inventories of several countries. Though branding and industrialisation, he says, complicate questions about food ownership and know-how. The relevant UNESCO committee that will assess Singapore's nomination for hawker culture has held its annual meeting only this week, though Singapore's nomination won't be assessed till next year.
Well, turns out I've had a Milo dinosaur before. If you asked me, I probably would have said no, but I'm pretty sure I have made it. What are your thoughts? Where do you think it stands? I'd love to hear them. You can send me a message on our ABC Radio Australia Facebook page. Anne Barker with that story there.
Big Ideas on Radio Australia.
Driverless cars are currently being trialled in every Australian state and territory. It's early days and we're a long way from a future where autonomous vehicles rule. But the technology's developing fast. So why choose autonomous vehicles? Just because we can, should we?
Casting light on some of the big issues and challenges of our time.
A recent report by McKinsey & Co. predicts the winners and losers from automation and artificial intelligence.
On average, we'd see over the next decade or so, around 25% of jobs in the most likely scenario not required. Some industries will be hit harder than others. Transport and manufacturing, which will be increasingly automated.
And discussing age-old questions.
Do animals have emotions? This question is hotly contested.
Be part of the conversation with Big Ideas on Radio Australia.
You're listening to a special summer edition of Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. My name is Talia Olatia. Now, Selena Tusitala Marsh is a New Zealand poet and scholar who was used to being the first to do things. She was the first in her family to go to university, the first Pacifica to graduate with a PhD in English from the University of Auckland, and the first Pacifica woman to become New Zealand's Poet Laureate. She's now teaching the next generation of poets about Pacifica and Māori poetry and sharing with them the power of Pacific poetry.
Kia ora, talofa lava, buluvanaka, maloilele, kia orana, whakalofalahi atu. Warm Pacific greetings to you all, and I bring all my ancestors with me from Samoa, Tuvalu, England, Scotland and France.
Selena, it is truly a pleasure to have you on Pacific Mornings. You're so acclaimed now as a poet, but do you remember the first poem that you wrote?
Oh, my Lord. Yes, indeed. So I was about 11 and I was made aware of the nuclear testing in Mururoa. And as an 11-year-old, I just thought, that's really unfair. That's really unfair. And I wrote a poem about the mushroom cloud and submitted it to a local Christian magazine that used to be delivered for free in our neighbourhood. And then I forgot all about it. And I was walking through my little hometown and someone came up to me and said, "Love that poem." The epiphany was like, wow, it had a life outside of my head. Mm. And it created all these connections that I didn't foresee, and I'd actually forgotten about it, and it moved someone enough to connect with me in person. And it kind of showed me that, you know, the power of the published word.
Mm.
And I wouldn't do it again until years later, but that was the first moment that I saw the power of poetry.
Mm. Did you grow up in a household where poetry and, you know, writing was used as a way of expression?
Oh, darling, 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 not at all. I just, you know, my Samoan Tuvaluan mother met my English Kiwi dad in Samoa and they married in Samoa. Their courtship was negotiated and translated by younger siblings because mum didn't speak English very well. She had to leave school early as the older sibling to work in an ice cream factory and pay towards her siblings' school fees. So she came to New Zealand barely able to speak English, and you know, she taught herself how to speak watching TV.
Yeah.
And we didn't really have books in the house, but somehow she knew that books were really, really important. So when we'd go shopping at the Salvation Army or the op shops, she'd always give me 50 cents and I could fill up a box full of books for 50 cents. And so inadvertently, she gave me a very wide, eclectic taste for literature of all kinds. Like I'd get cookbooks. I'd get, you know, and I remember the one thing she purchased from a traveling salesman was a shelf or a collection of encyclopedia. In her own way, she knew that, like a lot of migrant parents, that education was a pathway out.
Yeah. Just listening to you tell that story makes the fact that you were the first Pacifica to graduate with a PhD in English from the University of Auckland just so much more impressive. How you can go from that to collecting your 50 cents of books from the op shop. It's
well, you know, the thing that Mum fostered was like this curiosity. She cultivated a curiosity in me, and that is one of the biggest challenges I have as a lecturer in the university, dealing in a system that, you know, education is so compartmentalized and assessment driven. And, you know, I get students who just want to read to pass the exam, just, you know, to do enough to get the grade, to get into another course, to do that. So I see it as my job to also pass on this cultivation of curiosity. You know, what if? What does that look like? Why not read that? Yeah, it's an ongoing challenge.
Oh, no doubt. I do sometimes think poetry, and especially like, you know, old English texts, they do kind of have connotations with old white men doing things like that. The point that I guess I'm trying to make is representation and poetry and poetry as a vehicle of representation. How do you see it as your journey throughout your life? As no doubt there wasn't a lot of Pacifica poets that you may have been reading as a small child to now being a lecturer of Pacifica poetry.
There's a really powerful slide I have in one of my PowerPoints. I gave a keynote somewhere in the world, and it was the cover of a book that I had as a kid, and it was the closest thing I could find at that time to relate to, and it was called 10 Little Nigger Boys. 10 little nigger boys and 10 little nigger girls, and they all wore different dresses, and each one of them would be knocked off, somehow killed, somehow gotten rid of, you know, with the last little nigger girl getting eaten by a big white polar bear. And, you know, and I marvel at the agency of Indigenous people and people of colour who have to, you know, deal with that, like try and find themselves in the narrative, you know. And I remember distinctly being, yes, I was the little black Sambo nigger girl, but I was also the white consuming polar bear. Like I was both, right? Yeah. And that's, and having to navigate what now in retrospect is a very painful space, you know, but that's who we are. That's what we do. And when I was in my master's year and I was called into the office of Albert Wendt, forefather of Pacific literature, and Witi Ihamaira, forefather of Māori literature, and they said, you know, what are your plans? And, you know, I had no plans. I because there were no fees back then, I just kind of fell into and had the privilege of doing what I loved and following what I loved. But I certainly wasn't planning on staying at an institution where people who looked like me, sounded like me, thought like me were dropping off the higher you got, right? And they basically said, well, you're it. Like, we're going to retire. And
does that put pressure on you though?
Oh, insurmountable amounts of pressure. But, you know, as a good Samoan daughter, you do what your elders tell you to do, right? And so when they said, you're it, your grades are up there, you'll be doing a PhD, you need to make sure that the space that they've worked so hard and for the last 25 years to carve out at Auckland University, the space of Māori and Pacific literature, stays open. You know, there was no doubt in my mind. I didn't even question. What I questioned was myself, my own ability, my own worth. Am I Pacific enough? I was born in New Zealand. Am I Samoan enough to engage in, you know, kind of Pacific centered research? You know, all those doubts, and they didn't even give me time to voice those doubts. There's a poem where he just said, you know, well, look behind you. And I looked behind me and he said, what do you see? And I went, the door. Thinking that looked like
that's
a really
a weird
good
sign.
Place to be. And he said, there is nobody else to do this. This is your job. We've done it. We're handing it over to you. And, you know, they gave the same speech to the only other Māori woman in my position. So we came together and she walked away from it. Yeah. She just said, this is too hard. It's too hard being a Māori woman in this space. And I said to her, well, gosh, I'm amazed you can think like that. I don't have a choice. I don't feel like I have a choice. I'm here because of my community, my people, my ancestors. It's kind of, you know.
If you did have a choice, would you still be doing it?
Well, I thought I was going to be a vet, and then and I remember in Standard 4, you know, I'm quite tall. I'm like 6 foot, and all the tall people always have to stand at the back of the group, right? And we were at a local vet clinic, and I thought, damn it, this is going to be my passion. This is my life. And I pushed my way to the front just as the vet was slicing open a kitten's leg and re-breaking the bone, and then I fainted. So... I'm like, that's
maybe
not going
not
to be.
Maybe
not. Maybe I should have given it another go. I don't know.
But I do understand, like it's natural for people to feel doubtful. You know, you think that, well, someone's told me that this is what I'm going to do, and my idea of service is I do what you want me to do, while also feeling like massive imposter syndrome at the same time to be like, is someone going to catch me out, or are you just waiting for someone who's better or more qualified to come along? I'm like, what's going to happen?
Well, you know, it was really interesting when I embarked on my PhD and I looked at, to connect with what you said earlier, I looked at the first wave Pacific woman poets to publish a sole collection of poetry in English, because I did not know that they existed until my PhD year, right? And these were the first woman poets from Tonga, the Solomons, Vanuatu, Samoa, and Hawaii. And they've been writing since 1974. And so this was our best, worst kept secret, right?
Yeah.
And so I had written to each of these women. I'd told them what I was doing, who my supervisor was, and if I could interview them. And every single one of them came back going, finally, one of our own interested and able to read us in the way that we want to be read, and not kind of subject to this white literary canon or this white critical lens that just doesn't see or recognize the metaphors or the Pacific aesthetics.
Yeah.
Except the Samoan poet, right? The poet from Samoa. So she, and this is the days of letters, right? She wrote back this letter, and she essentially said, who the hell do you think you are, New Zealand-born Afakasi, to study my work? And I was like, right, that's it. I'm packing up shop. No, I can't do it. It's too, I knew I wasn't the right person. And I went to see Albert. I had the letter. I was crying. And he kind of just looked at me. You know, I mean, he did say that while he was head of department, he was in a bad mood for 10 years. He just kind of looked at me and said, that's just BS. He said, everybody's mongrels. You know, that family is a long line of German ancestry. And he said, you write back and tell her exactly who you are. Now, shut the door behind you. You know, that's as much as I got. And so I wrote this letter back to her, talking about who my grandfather was, who my mother was, our move here, and if I wasn't Samoan enough for her, then, you know, I regret that I won't be able to interview her, but I'll still include her, you know, because this is really important work and we're doing it for our people. And so she wrote back eventually, and the tone was so different. And she said, you know, I'm so glad that you've revealed yourself to me as a three-dimensional person. I'm so sick of researchers coming in here, making their careers off us and going back home. But now I know that you're actually in it for us, for our community. And so, you know, that was almost 20 years ago, and we've become fast, firm friends ever since then.
It's when you are teaching your students now, and, you know, you look at the impact that previous generations have made on you and the impact that you are making on future generations. Like, do you have an aim or a goal that is just like, if I just impart this to you, that will make me, you know, so happy. It will make me feel like my life's legacy has been met. Or is there anything like that?
Absolutely. I mean, I've got my first graphic mini memoir coming out in October, and it's called Mophead, how your difference makes the difference. And I've drawn the pictures myself, and it's me with massive, massive hair. And I was teased at school relentlessly and called mop head because it was just too big. Didn't fit anywhere. It broke all the cute clips. It was, you know, typical Samoan thick afro-y hair.
I find bobby pins in my hair that I put in like 3 days ago. I feel this right now.
We do things big. We do things really big.
Absolutely.
But it's a story of how your difference makes a difference for good or for ill. And it's if I could impart to my students one thing, it would be to see yourself, you know, see the unique things that make up you and turn them into your superpower. And actually that thing that you see or perceive as your weakness because it makes you stick out, that has the potential to be your superpower, you know. And so when I lecture to people, I know that what I say is one form of communication that they're receiving, but who I am in front of them is quite another.
Is there any chance that I can get you to recite a little bit of poetry now?
Absolutely. Yes. So how long do you want me to? I've got a chant. It's called Fast Talking PI, Fast Talking Pacific Islander.
Perfect.
And I wrote it when I was angry because the national newspaper went with the headline, Pacific Islanders Brown Undercut Class in New Zealand. And I thought that, you know.
Yeah.
So I responded with some stereotypes of my own. Fast-talking PI. I'm a fast-talking PI. I'm a power-walking PI. I'm a demographic, hieroglyphic, fact-sheet-welding PI. I'm a theorising PI. I'm a strategising PI. I'm published in a peer-reviewed journal PI. I'm a slot machine PI. I'm a lotto queen PI. I'm a tote ticket church bingo TAB PI. I'm a vegan PI, a rainbow warrior PI. I'm a protest sign against the rising waters PI. I'm a criminal PI, behind the bar graphs PI. I'm a gun smoking patch totin king cobra PI. I'm a whale PI. I'm a marae PI. I'm a living breathing dwelling of my ancestors PI. I'm a land-based PI, a whanua PI. I'm a village is the center of my world PI. I'm a harvesting PI, a copra sacking PI. I'm a bite and beef cause no more fish in reef PI. I'm a Siva Samoa PI. I'm an Ava pouring PI. I'm a Tula Fale tonguing genealogy PI. I'm an independent PI. I'm a flag raising PI. I'm a fa'a lovey, lovey, loving, given, living PI.
That was perfect. And I know that you still have so much to go because I was just like,
oh, darling, there's like 12 and a half minutes left. And the beauty with that poem is that it took on cult status in 2009 because I performed it and workshopped with schools up and down New Zealand, and kids kept adding their own stanzas. So there are 1,000 different versions because they would say to me, what about the bridge building PI? What about the, you know, haka PI? And I was like, yeah, well, bring it. Yeah. Add your own stanza. So that's a poem that has just kept growing and growing and growing.
What an impressive woman. That was New Zealand poet and scholar Selena Tusitala Marsh, who's teaching the next generation of poets about Pacifica and Māori poetry. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. I'll be back at the same time tomorrow morning, starting at 7 a.m. PNG time. And don't forget, you can find our top stories on our website. Just type Pacific Beat and Radio Australia in your search engine, and that should get you to where you need to go. Or you can always go to the Radio Australia page, which is www.abc.net.au/radio.
radio-australia. There you can listen to the Pacific Beat program live or catch up on full Pacific Beat programs and individual stories. And we also post our stories on Twitter. We're at Radio Australia with the hashtag Pacific Beat. So there are so many ways to find us online. I hope you have a happy and a safe Thursday. I'll catch you tomorrow for more Pacific Beat. My name is Talia Olatia.